We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
On Keeping the Faith today, we're talking about a brand new book called The Spirit of Food, 34 Writers on Feasting and Fasting Toward God. Let me welcome our two guests who are with us by telephone. First, from Alaska, Leslie Leland Fields, who is the editor of this book. Leslie, can you hear me all right?
I can hear you just great, all those thousands of miles away.
Great. And we have one of these 34 writers also on the line from the East Coast. This is Jeannie Murray Walker. Jeannie, are you connected with us both?
I am, and I'm delighted to be here, Steve. Thanks.
Well, our engineer is jumping up and down with pleasure that all of this works, and so am I, trust me. The Spirit of Food. Let's start with the editor, Leslie Leland Fields. May I call you Leslie?
You may. Please do.
Call me Steve, please. Now, let's see. You have you have this book just out. This is your seventh book, as I understand. And you have the cover article in this month's Christianity Today that's also on this topic.
Mm-hmm.
Is it fair to say you're the second most famous woman in Alaska?
You know what? I do get that quite a bit. And the funny thing is that Sarah and I have many life parallels. We both have large families. We both had surprise children at the end. We both commercial fish. So, we have a lot of parallels. Sometimes I'm mistaken for her, which, you know, of course, I have mixed feelings about.
Well, we won't ask you your politics, but let's do talk about the subject of both your Christianity Today article and The Spirit of Food, this new book that's just out. Why are you interested in food?
Well, you know, I think we all are we all are out of necessity, of course, because we don't eat, we die. And we all think about food at least three times a day, and I'm just willing to bet that we all think about food probably 30 times a day. So I'm like everybody else. You know, I think about food, and sometimes I work really hard to not think about food, which is another way of thinking about food. And I just realized that I don't think that we're thinking as fully as we should be about food, or that we've compartmentalized food into kind of this mechanical necessity part of our lives. That, you know, we have these bodies that have to be fed. We view our bodies as a machine and food as fuel. And in that perspective, I realized, wow, we're really missing out on the fullness of what food is intended to be.
I want to get back to that topic, of course, but tell me, since we have Jeannie Walker on the phone as well, who has also published a number of books of poetry, how did you select the writings that you put into this collection, The Spirit of Food?
Well, it was a lot of fun. It was, you know, part of this whole long process over several years. I thought about where food comes from and what we do with food, and I was able to kind of break it down into about six different categories. And then I thought about who can write from this perspective. And I found some things that were already out there, like, of course, Robert Farrar Capon's The Supper of the Lamb and his Heavenly Onion excerpt, which is so heavenly, and that's in the chapter in the kitchen, you know, actually preparing food. And so I had some friends who thought a lot about food and who I knew could write some of these essays. Jeannie was one of them. I just knew Jeannie to be such a thoughtful person and such a beautiful writer, and I asked her. So this is some of the writers. I actually sort of commissioned them. I said, "Hey, I'm doing this book. Would you consider writing something from your food life to contribute?"
Now, were you surprised when you got Jeannie's submission? Because as I read through the, I haven't read all 34 entries, but the ones I've read, Jeannie stands out as being different in an interesting way. Were you surprised?
You know, I was and I wasn't. I wasn't surprised because everything Jeannie writes surprises me. And that is the truth. I am always delighted by Jeannie's writing because she always takes me someplace unexpected. And this essay absolutely does that as well. So, I was surprised and delighted, and I thought this is so important to include in the book because, and I hope Jeannie will read from something from her piece a little bit later, but how this this very imperfect farmer's market became such a picture of a fellowship and communion over food and became the means that she ends up returning to church. And yes, I was surprised, but I was not surprised that Jeannie surprised me.
Let's let Jeannie say a few words about the process of writing something sort of on commission. Was that a new experience for you, Jeannie?
No, actually, I've written about 8 or maybe 10 essays on commission, and I'm now trying to make them into a book. So I'm frequently asked to write essays, and then what you got after you finish that is 10 essays that don't have much to do with one another. So a press has come to me and asked me to collect them, and I'm trying to make them into some kind of a coherent, you know, an umbrella theme, some kind of a plot that works them all together. But it was food is something that almost anybody can write about. Just as Leslie says, I couldn't agree with her more. You got to eat or you die. And beyond that, it's a way that we sit down together and take time. And I think one of the things that's a real blessing about food right now in our culture is we're so speedy that if you can make yourself slow down and cook the way I usually do, in fact, every night after I finish this interview, I'm going to go into the kitchen and cook. And, you know, we're pretty serious about food around here, not solemn, but we like good food.
Let me let listeners know that following almost every essay in this collection is also a recipe. And your recipe that you selected is scalloped potatoes for the church potluck. And I'll let you say a word or two about how you...
Hey, Jeannie, ate those. I just made those this last week and ate them, and they were wonderful.
Good. I'm glad it worked.
How did you pick out that recipe, Jeannie?
Well, I thought it's good to have something that's relatively simple. Writing recipes is in itself an art, and I'm not, you know, I don't know how to do that. But I think that church potlucks, when I was a child, were among those communal meals that I remember the best. I think we remember holiday feasts and communal potlucks that we used to have in our little Baptist church when I was a kid. You would go raise the tinfoil above one of the dishes and say, "Oh, Mrs. Shamber brought her scalloped potatoes, you know, yay!" So I think it's communal, and the essay is really about communion.
It's called The Communion of Saints, and that is one of the essays by the 34 writers on feasting and fasting toward God in the collection The Spirit of Food, edited by Leslie Leyland Fields, who's also on the air with us this afternoon on Keeping the Faith from Alaska. And Jeannie, tell us where you are.
Well, I am in Philadelphia, where I live.
And you're a professor still at nearby?
Yeah, at the University of Delaware. And for those of you who don't know the Eastern Seaboard, Delaware is about 20 minutes away from Philadelphia. So it takes me about 45 minutes to get to work, but it's pretty close.
And Jeannie, would you be willing to read a little bit from a small selection from the Communion of Saints, your offering to this collection?
Well, I sure will. I'll read about a paragraph, and it's the it's the second page. It's raining. I wake up alone in bed. My husband's coming home this afternoon from a conference, and I know I have to get food. Vegetables, I think, know about dark, cold rain. They come from the earth. Soon I'm parking and walking towards Produce Junction. The rain has thinned to mist. The wind turns my umbrella inside out. Out of the corner of my eye, I notice a cardboard box flying through the air. Turning, I spot a semi filled with boxes of mushrooms. The man unloading his truck has stumbled and lost his footing, so hundreds and hundreds of button mushrooms are raining down all over the driveway and sidewalk. He curses vibrantly. Shoppers stop to briefly watch, snickering, then hurry on through the mist. He surveys the soggy mess, kneels to pick up the mushrooms, peers around at us, his audience, and grins. Some of us stop to help him, hands of all sizes and shades and ages, mine among them, drop wet mushrooms into his box. I realize I've come here every day this week, and I can't remember why. Not because I needed to buy food, I know, although I can't afford the time to keep coming back. When I feel the call of the place, I come.
And Produce Junction, you write, is a simple one-story shack. And it's next to an abandoned rickety garage you describe. I've never been there, of course, but I can see it. You describe it so well. And also, your description of the, I'll try not to give anything away in this wonderful narrative, but the story you tell of the church officer's discussion certainly rang true to me, who sat through a few of those in my lifetime.
Well, yeah, it was a dust up on the vestry, and you know that happens all the time. There was a fracture in the church, and it split. And during that year or two, I had no church I could call my own, and I really went almost every day to Produce Junction. There was food there, and it was like church in the sense that I could find people who were old, people who were children, people who were of all different ethnic varieties, and it's a very sustaining place. People are going there on their way to the table.
Let's switch back to Leslie, and let me reintroduce our guest for listeners who may have joined us later. Leslie Leyland Fields is the editor of The Spirit of Food, published just this year, a collection of 34 writers on feasting and fasting toward God. Where did the title come from, Leslie? And subtitle.
Yeah, I don't know. It kind of, I thought of, this book came to me about 5 years ago, and as the idea came to me, the title came at the same time. And I think I really wanted to bring together, you know, the spirituality of food. I think so many times food can be an end in itself. It's sort of the food of food. And I wanted to reintroduce this other really essential element to it, the spirit of food.
When you began writing, your life is so busy. You mentioned having many children and one that was unexpected. You have, what, 6 kids?
I do.
And you also participate in the commercial fishing industry in Alaska with your spouse. You teach at the college level, writing. How do you yourself carve out time to write and to edit in this case? Well, and
yeah.
one of your essays is in this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a challenge. I do have lots of plates. I'm juggling a lot of plates, and it is a challenge. And every day I just try to get up and say, what are the essential things to do today? And I try to approach each one with joy. And you know, if the joy starts to fade, and I'm not working out of joy and out of love, then I know, okay, this plate needs to be set down. So it's an everyday thing.
What are the ages of your children?
22 down to 7.
And was it your last book that dealt with parenting?
Yeah. I never thought I would write a book about parenting, but it's actually, it's sort of a Mythbusters, you know, parenting Mythbusters. It's called Parenting is Your Highest Calling and Eight Other Myths That Trap Us in Worry and Guilt. So it is, in essence.
By myths, you mean lies.
Well, yeah, you know, lies. I wanted lies in the title, but my editor said, no, that's too harsh. I did mean lies. You are so right.
I think I read that somewhere. I'm not sure where I got that. Maybe on your website, an earlier draft of your proposed title.
Probably.
And our other guest on the phone that we just heard read an excerpt from her wonderful essay that's in The Spirit of Food is Jeannie Murray Walker, who has published, as we heard her say, several other articles on commission and has published, had seven books of poetry published. The last one called New Tracks, Night Falling. And if you'd like to hear her read some of those, you can go to the Keeping the Faith website at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith, and you can hear her talking about that book and reading some of the poetry from that book. Jeannie, is this your third time on this show? I think it may be.
Yeah, I think it is. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Well, thank you for doing it. You keep writing, we'll keep talking with you.
I don't seem to be able to stop writing, so there we go. It's going to be a long, you know, future together. Yeah.
Let me invite listeners to join this conversation. The phone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, if it's a local call, punch in 333-9455. That's within the 217 area code, 333-WILL. If it's a long-distance call, and even if you're listening on the Internet, you may use this toll-free number if you're in the U.S., 1-800-222-9455. So if it's long-distance, 1-800-222-WILL. Now, one thing I'm not sure about is if people are in either Hawaii or Alaska, if that number will work. I suppose we should just try it and see. If you're listening to this on your computer at will.illinois.edu, you can try that number if you'd like to join the conversation. I know it works within the continental U.S. Leslie, let's get back to you. When you were pulling these things together, did you know you were going to write an article for this, or did that come first, or how did that come about?
Yeah, I did. In fact, I had been keeping notes on my essay is about making bread, and I'd been keeping notes on that subject for probably 5 years, because bread making was such a huge part of my life, and it's really intertwined with a lot of joy and a lot of really heartbreak and hard things too. And so I felt a deep compulsion to write something about making bread, and maybe the book was an excuse to do that. I don't know.
I read your recipe, your description of the perfect loaf of bread, and it was just beyond belief. It was so strange.
Oh, the recipe.
The recipe.
Oh, good. I was hoping you weren't saying that about my essay.
No.
the essay was really fun because it recounted the first time making this, you know, what is called on the Internet the perfect loaf of bread, and it's a no-knead bread. And, of course, all the listeners, they're only hearing me say it, so they know that knead is K-N-E-A-D. And I had been kneading bread, you know, for 40 years, all of my life, and, you know, since I was about 10. And so here's this recipe claiming perfection for something that you almost don't even have to touch. I mean, let me take that back. You don't have to touch it, you know, not touched by human hands. So that was sort of the challenge is, okay, I'm going to try this recipe, and is it really going to be perfect? And then it led to the whole question of what is perfection, really, and then what is the value of our human making?
And then the recipe you include at the back, tell us about that one. Hannah's Tiger Bread.
Yeah. I live out on a remote, every summer, my husband and children and I commercial fish for salmon, and we move out to a remote island where just my family and I live. And over the years, I've had young women come out to help me with all of my children and with the fishing. And for two summers, we had a young woman named Hannah who just came with just a lot of anger and a lot of issues. And we became very close, and one of the things that I taught her was how to make bread. And we spent many hours together in the kitchen baking bread, and anyone who makes bread and needs bread knows just this, there's this amazing physicality and amazing healing and therapy that comes through the handling of that dough that almost feels like a body. It almost feels alive. And Hannah, we really just visibly saw her grow and change and heal and soften, and she began to love cooking and love the kitchen, and she ended up taking over the kitchen and just cooking and the most wonderful food and baking bread. And but the tragic thing happened after that second summer. She ended up taking her own life, and at the age of 23. And that was, of course, a great sorrow to our whole family. And this bread that we had made together, we called it Tiger Bread, and it's a blend of a kind of a sweet egg bread with a chocolate bread, and that's rolled together. So it's this beautiful spiral. And we had made that up together, and we called it Tiger Bread. And after Hannah died, it had to be hers. It was her bread. So I called it Hannah's Tiger Bread.
We're talking with Leslie Fields about her newest book that she's edited, The Spirit of Food, and also with Jeannie Murray Walker. Jeannie, are you still there? We heard a little squeak.
Yep,
okay,
I'm here.
Good. Great, all right. We always worry when our guests are by phone because we hope they can stay on the whole time and that nothing technically prevents that. When you were putting this book together, you wanted to do something that connected the spirit to food. Why is spirituality an issue when we're talking with food? Leslie?
I think, we all know that we're living in a time when our whole nation is struggling with food disorders, whether it's obesity, and we do lead the industrialized nations. We really lead the world in obesity rates, whether it's obesity or it's backlash, eating disorders. And clearly there's something amiss, very deeply amiss, in our relationship to food, the way we think about food. And I think at the heart of it is just a lack of understanding about the whole spiritual component of food. And I think we're looking to food to fill all of our hungers, our bodily hungers, but our spiritual hungers, our emotional hungers, we're looking to food to fill it. And but if we don't know the author of the creator who created food and designed food and gave it to us as a gift, food becomes its own end. And I think there's just so many issues and so much dysfunction around food. I wanted to open up the whole subject and help us to see that food is intended not just for our body but for our spirit as well. And when we see food more holistically, I think food can heal us, it can nourish us, it can draw us closer to one another, it can draw us closer to God, it can draw us closer to the creation that he's made. And I think that's what God intended when he gave us food.
And some of your 34 writers in this very good collection deal with issues that talk about problems people have with food, everything from bulimia to as you say, obesity. And one of your authors in his article mentioned that obesity, now the CDC says, is is second only to people who smoke tobacco in the leading causes of death. It's just a major issue in our society, as you say.
And you know, even if it's not a death issue, it is such a well-being issue. Just the sense of being in a healthy body just is so important to being alive in some existential way. And I think a lot of kids are missing that even. It's not even just adults. It's kids as well.
You also include essays in the book that deal with fasting, with choosing to go without food. My very few experiences with fasting, I spent the whole day thinking about food. I mean, food's just all around you. You realize how many advertisements there are, how many photos, and of course the smells just walking around town. I was trying to do without food, and I just was surrounded by it.
Mm-hmm. The whole topic of fasting is really a fascinating topic. And Jesus assumed that we would all fast. You know, he said, when you fast. He didn't say, if you fast. He said, when you fast. So there was an assumption there. It was very much a part of the earlier religious culture, you know, than it is today. And in our culture of excess and indulgence, you know, we are afraid of hunger. Now, I know I am. You know, I'm afraid of hunger. I'm afraid of any kind of, you know, personal pain. But I think withdrawing from food for a time, and whether it's just skipping one meal or whether it's just eating very simply, very minimally for a day or two at a time, I have experienced just some real benefits. And one immediate benefit as we come into Thanksgiving here is that, I tell you what, you learn to be grateful for food. And, you know, we feast every day. I think most of us do. And I think the way to really return to a gratitude for our food is to step back from food for a little while and to realize how dependent we are upon it. And I tell you what, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich tastes really good when you've gone a day without eating.
You mentioned one of the possibly most famous writers about food in terms of a Christian setting when you mentioned Robert Farrar, and you pronounced it Capon. I always have said Capon, like the chicken. Do you know that's how he says it? I've never known.
You know what? I don't know either. I've been saying, I think I said Capon. I really don't know.
Well, I had the opportunity to meet him once and even introduced him, and he didn't correct me when I said Capon. So,
okay. All right. I will take it from you.
Well, that may be correct. But at any rate, his book, The Supper of the Lamb, that you have this wonderful chapter from about the heavenly onion, is just so central. And I noticed that I've read maybe half of the essays in your book. I apologize for not finishing it. But at any rate, I think I've run across already three references from your writers to his writing, particularly The Supper of the Lamb. Tell us a little bit about why you selected that particular chapter from that classic book of his.
Well, in that excerpt, again, it's called The Heavenly Onion, and it's a whole chapter just on slicing an onion. And it's such a beautiful and lyrical and meditative piece. And he encourages us to stop. You know, most of us chop onions. We just cut through that thing and throw it into the pot as quick as we can so we don't, you know, end up sobbing, you know, with the onion juice in our eyes. But he really makes us slow down and see the onion for its incredible beauty and its translucency and the layers and it becomes this very absorbing observation of the onion becomes a meditation on heaven. And you know, what he's saying in effect is that the beauty and the order and the lushness and the flavor of this onion really points us to the presence of God and the reality, you know, the reality even of the life to come. So it really is kind of a picture of what I think food can do, is that it is and its tangibility and its physicality and its sensuousness. All of those things are spiritual things. They all feed our spirit, and they're all God's idea. So this whole kind of dualism between, you know, spirit and body, you know, we're just knocking that wall down, because the spiritual and the physical are all very intricately intertwined.
Well, and I think also that chapter gives all of us a model for how to pay attention.
Yes.
And by paying attention, you need to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you need, he says, to take an hour with this onion, which, of course, is in some ways the lowliest member of the vegetable clan. And if you slow down like that over an onion, then you start walking more slowly. And I'm convinced that out of stillness and silence comes a kind of paying attention that leads to reverence, and that leads to loving things of the world as well as maybe loving even your own body in a way which is partly reverence too.
An earlier poet in Hebrew wrote, "Be still and know that I am God," collected in the Psalms. Here I found it. This is the last line in Robert Farrar Capon's essay collected in this book, The Spirit of Food. "One real thing is closer to God than all the diagrams in the world." And, of course, those of us who have had theological training are so easy at making diagrams and explaining, oh, this is what the Trinity's like, or this is... And Capon says, one real thing, like an onion, is closer to God than all the diagrams in the world. A wonderful line.
I think, you know, in this book, one of the things that surprised me about reading this book when I got it several months ago was the essays are very attentive to specific things. There's an essay here called In Praise of Hollandaise. And it's partly about chemistry, and it's partly about a chef, who is in a big restaurant kitchen. But it is very attentive to one sauce and why that sauce works and how exactly you can make it work. So it's partly practical, but it's also partly a reflection. And there's a wonderful essay about farming written by a woman who lives on a farm who deeply, deeply loves the particular landscape of their farm and the question of whether they can afford to buy another little piece.
Another 200 acres, yes.
Exactly. And, you know, that deep love for the physical, the land, and the particular landscape, and not just because it's beautiful, but also because it's necessary to produce food. And I think that runs through the whole book.
We're about halfway through our Keeping the Faith program for this Sunday evening. Let me remind listeners, you may join the conversation by calling 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. If you're listening long distance, even on the internet, at will.illinois.edu/am, you may call us on our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Perhaps you have questions of these two cooks as well as writers, Leslie Fields and Jeannie Walker. The Spirit of Food has come out just this year. 34 writers on feasting and fasting toward God. It's been published by Cascade Books in Eugene, Oregon. That's a imprint of Wipf and Stock Publishers. The Spirit of Food. It also has some wonderful recipes in it. I haven't had it long enough to be able to try any of the recipes myself. My wife is by far a better cook, but I look forward to trying some of these. Leslie, tell us a little bit about scripture references to food.
Yeah.
The Jewish and Christian scriptures, the Hebrew Bible, the Greek New Testament has a lot of food in it.
Really does, and in fact, it's a really fun study. If you just, you know, even if you took one word, like if you take the word bread, and do a study of bread, starting from right from the beginning of the Old Testament all the way through, it's really fascinating. So it's a huge topic. The scriptures are full of so much discussion about food and a lot of feasting and a lot about fasting, and there are parables about food, and Jesus calls himself the bread of life and the living water, and at the heart of the Christian faith is a meal, what we call the Lord's table or the Lord's Supper or the Eucharist. We have lots of different words for it. And in the Jewish faith, there's the Passover meal, which is very important, as well as the other Old Testament feasts. So it's a huge topic, and it's a lot of fun to track through. I don't have time to do it now, but I hope that's just a little bit of a glimpse.
Now, in your essay that's the cover essay in Christianity Today, the November issue, you talk about how many of the attitudes in American culture today seem to be influenced by Eastern thought when it comes to doing without food, vegetarianism, being a vegan.
Yeah. You know, there's a phrase that's being used a lot now, and I love the phrase. It's about eating mindfully, and it's a wonderful phrase, and it really comes from, I would say it comes from Eastern thought, from Buddhism and from Hinduism, where being thoughtful about what you eat, you know, it's always been an important part of those traditions. And so now when we hear a lot about eating mindfully, we tend to connect it to Buddhism and Hinduism. But the truth is that it's always been very essential to Christianity as well. I mean, God always intended us to be thoughtful about the food that we eat. In fact, one of the very first things that God ever said in the Garden of Eden, and this is, you know, the scriptures open in a garden, you know, where food is being grown and there are fruit trees. And one of the first things that God says is, you know, I have given all of this to you for food. But, you know, you're not to eat of this tree. So one of the opening scenes in the Hebrew scriptures is all about food.
Thomas Maltman, one of the 34 authors who is part of your collection, he's a wonderful novelist, Nightbirds was one of his award-winning novels. He writes about famine, and he mentions the horrible fact that 29,000 children die each day from malnutrition in our world. He goes on to talk about how in his religious practice, working with young people, trying to see what they can do practically themselves to make a difference, and so to be able to help people who are starving to death, what American school children could do, has some very practical advice. I didn't expect to get that kind of practical help from this book, but I was delighted to find that here.
There's another essay which is a bit funny, but it's also, I mean, it really is a deeply honest essay about, I think it's called My Self-Righteous Food Stamp Fast by LaVon Neff. And it's about trying to live on food stamps and why, if somebody who's middle class tries to do that, the conditions are altogether different than they would be for somebody who has to do that every day of the year. And there are just a lot of reflections that are like that. There's an essay about vegetarianism, for example, by somebody who for many years was a vegetarian and was thinking through that process and finally came to a different conclusion. And so for me, this book was a big surprise in the way that it not only offers practical advice, as you say, Steve, but also offers a kind of honest evaluation. It's not trendy, and it's written by so many different authors that you get a lot of different points of view.
I appreciated the articles that I read that were written by people who were practicing vegans and vegetarians about why they thought that was a moral choice.
Yeah.
And
Steve, I was just going to say, there's one that we're talking about, sort of the practical aspect of this book. There's an essay in there called "Go Feed People" by the chef who founded Mercy Chefs, and it's this amazing organization that goes into places where disasters have occurred, and they set up a kitchen and they simply feed people. And he tells the story of the founding of this ministry, and it was right after Hurricane Katrina. And he's in Haiti now. He's been in Haiti, I think, since the earthquake there. But again, that's such a great prod to our souls, is go feed people. And, you know, part of what we are being asked to do is not only to feed ourselves well, but maybe even more importantly, to feed other people, especially the hungry.
And a couple of your writers, I can't remember which ones at the moment, but said that one of the benefits of doing practical things to help others who are hungry is that then you can eat without guilt. You can enjoy the good gifts that are sustaining you and be thankful. I thought that's very good news. One of your writers, this is the chapter 14 on choice cuisine, and I was intrigued by this one because it really talks about the environmental costs of the way we produce so much of our food in America now. And
produce and also
transport.
Get it to market. Yeah, that's right.
You are eating locally when you go to your fresh vegetable place.
That's true. We are eating locally, and many of the vegetables are fairly ugly, and they are not beneath plastic. You pick them up in your arms, and they are phenomenally inexpensive because they're gotten from farmers, and it's kind of like a co-op where it goes from the farmer to the market. And there's no bagging or packaging in between. And so you just walk up juggling all these different vegetables in your arms, and of course they fall on the floor and people pick up one another's vegetables. And you get up to the counter and you're supposed to get 6 cucumbers and you only need one for the salad, and you end up kind of giving some of the cucumbers to the people who are around you standing in line, and we all end up sharing and giving each other recipes for things that we've never seen before, like kohlrabi. Not everybody makes that, and you say, well, what is this vegetable? And pretty soon you've been striking up a conversation with people that you've never met before. And yeah, so there are lots of advantages in addition to the local not having to transport vegetables very far, and fruits too.
I'm at a huge disadvantage living on an island in Alaska, and whenever I come outside and, you know, and I see farmers markets, I turn green as a cucumber with envy. I really do. But the closest that I can come is an organic food co-op, and our stuff gets shipped up from Oregon. But what's wonderful about that, and it's very similar to what Jeannie is saying, is that So I get this box of food, this big box of fruits and vegetables every other week, and I never know what you know what's going to be in the box. It just, you know, it appears, and that's what we've got. Somebody has ordered it, and here it is, and there are these vegetables. Sometimes I think, what is this thing, and how on earth do you eat it or cook it? And then I get to learn, you know, I get to learn about what to do with a box full of leeks, you know, what to do with a kohlrabi, and I feed, you know, my kids stuff maybe they wouldn't choose, but that's great. I mean, where do we get the idea that we should be able to choose the exact thing that we want at the exact moment that we want? And it's much more the way people have eaten for thousands of years.
There is something, you know, we were talking previously about fasting, and there is something wonderful about greeting the spring and having the first asparagus and not having it all winter long. You understand that it's a spring vegetable and you only get cranberries for a short time. And that seasonal kind of eating can be truly wonderful. And then the other part of it is the perishability of these vegetables. If you get a lot of them, you either need to share them with your neighbors or with people at Produce Junction or give them to your children, or else you're involved in the death cycle of the vegetables. And that kind of perishability reminds you of, you know, we're all prey to the same kind of, we're in this life cycle. And that very tangible reminder, I think, is useful to me.
We're about 10 minutes from the end of our Keeping the Faith program this Sunday night. Let me remind listeners, although you're, of course, we're delighted to have you just listen to our two guests and me converse, but if you'd like to join us, you may do that, 333-9455 if you're in the 217 area code near Champaign-Urbana. If you're listening long distance, call us toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We're talking today with the authors of the new book, The Spirit of Food, 34 Writers on Feasting and Fasting Toward God. Leslie Leland Fields is the editor of this collection, and one of the authors whose article is included is Jeannie Murray Walker. Jeannie is in Philadelphia, and Leslie is in Alaska, and I'm here in the Midwest, the breadbasket of America, surrounded by fields of corn and soybeans. Interestingly, one of your writers made a small mistake, I think, when he was talking about the corn that's grown here in the Midwest. He was talking about driving through, I think he said, 1,500 miles of cornfields when he was taking a trip. And he asked someone, you know, why that needed to be so much corn grown. And the answer was, well, there's just a lot of people who eat cornflakes. And the truth of the matter is that most of the field corn goes not to produce food directly, but rather to be eaten by animals, which we then in turn eat. And another of your writers, you talked about the differences within your collection, Leslie. Another of your writers pointed out that that's a choice we make in eating so much meat. Some of us here in the Midwest often three times a day eat meat. But it's possible that if there were the political will and the way to transport food, if instead of growing that much field corn to feed animals, if we just grew crops that people could eat vegetables, there might be enough to actually feed the whole world, which with 7 billion people can't be done with so much of the land being used to produce food for animals, which we then consume in the West primarily.
Yeah, so, and there's a lot of discussion about that. In periodicals, online, that's a really big issue right now. Do we really need to eat so much meat, and do we really need to really kind of exhaust our natural resources in service to that? And I think there's a pretty compelling argument. First, there's a compelling health and dietary argument to cut down on the meat that we eat. But also, I think there's a really strong environmental argument to, and I'm not saying to eradicate, you know, the feeding of animals and the use of animals. But I really do think that we should reduce and shift some of our resources toward growing more plant material, feeding more people. And another aspect to that is just the amount of pollution from industrialized farming methods. It's really quite appalling when you start looking into some of that.
We have a caller waiting on line number one. Let's go to that call. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
I've enjoyed your conversation very much and learned quite a bit about it. But there's one thing that I've heard, that there's a very great amount of the acreage of corn produced for ethanol. Wonder if your writers could discuss that matter.
Thank you very much for the question. Appreciate it. Do you happen to remember, Leslie, if any of the writers deal with that issue?
No, we don't, because we're really focused on plant material as food, and so that's kind of in another direction. The use of, as the caller said, the use of the growing, you know, plants, corn for fuel. And so I'm gonna plead ignorance on that and say that's a little bit, you know, outside the provenance of this particular book.
I know the University of Illinois, a college of ACES that deals with agriculture research, is looking at. I think I took a tour recently. I think there are over 400 acres they're experimenting with other types of growing plants to produce fuel. Plants and even trees, certain types of trees that may well be a fuel source. Because
my understanding is that ethanol is very costly to produce in terms of environmental damage, so that it's almost as much of a liability as oil is. Now, I am no expert. Like Leslie, I need to stick with what I know. But I think that, as you say, Steve, those things are just in the research phase. And I very much hope that we can figure out other kinds of energy, sun energy, wind energy.
Yeah, it's a little bit sad to me to think of using our really precious soil and, you know, the acres and miles of land that we have used for feeding people and transferring that to fueling our cars when we have, so many other sources, real usable sources. And I think the funding is moving away from that. The research funding is moving much more toward wind and tidal energy and just, you know, rather than using our land.
Leslie Fields, you're not only an editor and a writer, but also a commercial fisher person. And you talked about the salmon that you harvest in the summers off another island in Alaska. You don't write about this in your essay collected in The Spirit of Food, but I can't let you go without asking what you think about farm-raised salmon.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you might guess that I'm not real appreciative of farm-raised salmon, and you would be correct in that guess. Farm salmon has been around for a while. In the United States, it's been, you know, commercially available for, I'm just going to guess and say, 15 years. And when farm salmon from countries like Chile in particular and Scotland and Norway began coming into the country, wild salmon, are, you know, sustainable salmon, the salmon that we catch, the market prices for our fish just absolutely collapsed. And we used to get $2.50 a pound for red salmon and went down to less than 50 cents a pound. And
our pink salmon were 50 cents a pound and went down to 5 cents a pound. So farm salmon flooded the market, and the American consumer at that point, and really for I'd say for about 10 years, did not understand or recognize the difference that this was another kind of salmon, that this was a farm salmon coming from thousands of miles away and coming from a method of production that was devastating the ocean floor underneath it. And it was also, the fish were being fed all kinds of antibiotics and their waters were filled with pesticides, and people were not aware of that. In the last, I'd say, 5 to 8 years, people have become very aware of this distinction between the farm-raised and the environmental costs of farm-raised fish, plus they're nutritionally deficient compared to the wild Alaska salmon. And so, yeah, you can see, I could talk about this for a long time.
Jeannie, you said there were some other essays that you've enjoyed in the book other than your own. What ones stick in your memory?
Well, I think I honor this book because of its including essays on anorexia and bulimia, which I think is a bold and brave thing to do in a book about food. It's the other side of hunger, which, you know, we were talking about before. There are people who are hungry. There is such a thing as fasting, and then there's carrying that too far. And the two essays about that by Suzanne Wolf and Gina Oshner are just wonderful, wonderful essays. And then there was another essay about celiac disease, which is about the rice cracker host at the Eucharist, which I loved because my husband happens to not be able to eat gluten. So around here we've cleaned out all the stuff that has any gluten in it, and surprisingly enough, that includes mustard, that includes kinds of ketchup, that includes all kinds of sauces and soups and all kinds of other things. Once you do it, it's fairly easy. It's not a trauma at all, but it's just a very interesting kind of allergic reaction, and people are allergic to peanuts and so forth like that in this country now in a way that they didn't used to be.
We need to stop, I'm afraid. We are out of time, but let me thank our two guests by phone, Leslie Leland Fields, the editor of The Spirit of Food, 34 Writers on Feasting and Fasting Toward God, a new book out just this year, and we've also been talking with Jeannie Murray Walker, one of the authors of one of the essays. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for Keeping the Faith, and next week we'll be talking with a very noted poet, C.D. Wright, about her newest book, One with Others, that has been nominated for the National Book Award this year. The following week we'll be talking with mezzo-soprano Elizabeth Buckley and John Sutherland about a new Bach cantata. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
Thanks, Steve.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.